Okay, it's March 29th, 2005. I'm sitting on the back porch at Dick Catan's house, getting ready to reminisce about being in the Department of Psychology. I have a short list of 9 questions that kind of go in chronological order.
Okay.
But we can do whatever
happens.
We'll
run around, I suspect.
Whatever happens is fine.
Yeah.
If we start in chronological order, that means we start with your background. I know that you got a bachelor's degree in music at Hart.
It was out of the University of Hartford, which is Hart College of Music.
Hart College.
Right.
Then you went to Syracuse, where you got your PhD.
Right.
Then the University of North Carolina, where you did your internship.
Right.
But fill us in. Before that, what is interesting about your career is that you got your PhD in the mid-30s or something like that, which meant that you did other things, unlike some of us who went straight through.
Yeah.
You had other interests, so tell us about it.
Well, first of all, starting in my real youth, like at 7 years old, I wanted to play the guitar, and I couldn't reach the end of it. So my dad suggested a violin, and so that started me off as a violin player. And it was very much living out my dad's wishes, too, because he had wanted to be a violinist, and even right up until the point where he was in business, late at night after he'd closed the store, he would practice. And I was always jealous of him for the fact that he had much thicker hands and much thicker fingers than I had, so that it was easier for him to make a more beautiful sound than I could make. But I was fortunate enough to have good instruction, and my first career was as a violinist. I went to Juilliard. I organized a quartet, the Degas String Quartet. We toured the country with the National Music League managing us. But I realized that I really didn't like to practice, that I wasn't as good as the best. There were violinists who were far better than I was. And I lived with them. I could see what they could do and what I could do. And besides not liking to practice, there was the question of making a living. And just to give you an illustration, this may not sound so terrible, but my quartet might give 30 concerts a year traveling around the country. And we would clear, each of us, $1,500. And that was a year? That's right. And so we were doing all kinds of jobs. I was playing every kind of wedding and every kind of celebration. I was playing in orchestras, chamber orchestra, regular orchestra, any job that came along to try to make a living. And Enid, when we were married, I met her at Juilliard. Between the two of us, our salary at Hart College, where we were teaching, was $3,000 in 1952, and we went there to teach. So I figured that this was not the way that I wanted to struggle making a living. And my father became ill and said he would at least double my salary if I came back. I could always have music and run the business. And so I went back to Utica, New York, where my dad had, starting in a stable, built up a very strong appliance and jewelry business. And I had already learned in my childhood, just going into the store, how to evaluate diamonds and how to sell merchandise. And so I took over the store, and I ran that business from 1955 for 2 years, and realized that I was not going to stand up the rest of my life selling refrigerators. That was just not my thing. So I decided to test myself out and see if I could go back to school and still do a good job, because at that point I had no degree. I had taken courses all around. I've always been interested in things. I would take courses at the Rand School on Shakespearean literature and philosophy at the New School. And in fact, one of the professors started teaching me Latin and Greek, thinking that I might go on into philosophy, which was an interest of mine even as a child, and religions, comparative religion. And so I decided to go back to Utica College at night after we closed the store and take some courses, which I did. It was, I took a course in psychology and a course in child development, child psychology and regular psychology. And I got to know Abe Judson, who was a social psychologist and a very good one. And I did well enough. He encouraged me. He said, I think you should go up to Syracuse and talk to Calvin Hall. And that was a name I knew. He had written the personality through his book with Lindsay. And so I went up, that's right, Paul and Lindsay, one that I used when I began to teach at Vanderbilt. And so I went to speak with Calvin Hall, and that was a very interesting experience. I did not have a degree. And he didn't want to really talk about anything except my experience in New York City with the painters and the artists and the writers, because among the things I had done, I had written for a magazine called International Theater Magazine. When my quartet would go around the country, I would take in whatever theater was there and write a review for International Theater Magazine. So he liked that, and then he wanted to know who I knew in the village, because I had lived in the village for a while. It was Ratner, the painter, St. Butnick. This picture of Lydia hangs on the wall that looks so much like Edith. So he enjoyed talking with me, and he said, why don't you go downstairs and take our entrance exam while you're here? So I said, fine, you know, I'll go downstairs and take your entrance exam. And what they were using was Miller analogies at that time, together with grade point stuff. So, frankly, he said one of the problems was that people who scored over 92 on the Miller analogies rarely finished a degree because they had too many interests and they would not focus well enough. But they would allow me to enter if I would get a degree and if I would take their statistics course, which I thought, well, gee, that's just great because I love math. So I took the statistics course and I went back to Hart College and I asked them if I could get a degree by examination. And they agreed. So I talked with the history professor on a few occasions. I conducted the orchestra, which I used to be the director's assistant conductor anyway. So I conducted the orchestra in the Beethoven Third Symphony and played the Brooke Violin Concerto, part of a program for the committees there, and they gave me a bachelor's degree. And Syracuse honored that, which was, you know, isn't that a godsend?
Yes.
I mean, if one believes in God, God is on my side. Is that so? It's to me, it's and as you know, see, Syracuse allowed me to enter at 30 years old, and this was why when I became director of the graduate studies, I always was very sensitive to an older person. That if we felt that they had what it would take, John Pless was one of them that we took exceptions for. Because they were older, and the committee thought, after looking at things, that yes, we will, and it was the same with what some women do at that time. So I began to champion, in a sense, my own cause when I saw that in some other students, and sometimes it worked out well, and sometimes not so well, but at least I gave that a try. So anyway, I did Syracuse, and Shaggy Dean immediately, this was very interesting, because I entered the following September. I'd gone up to see him in the middle of winter. I took that course, the statistics course, and you know, you're a mathematician yourself, and a researcher, but math has been very strong in your life. And I enjoyed mathematics tremendously. When I went to take a calculus course for the fun of it at Trinity College, it was many years after my training in algebra, geometry, and stuff, and they gave me an entrance exam to see if I could take the course, and you know, I couldn't come anywhere near passing it. I couldn't remember anything. And the professor at Trinity said, you know, I don't think you can handle this. You don't have the background in algebra, even. I couldn't remember what to do. So I said, well, don't worry. I'm paying. It's an extracurricular course. I'm paying for it. So as you might imagine, with my drive, who was number one in the class was I. I was number one by the time I got everything back in shape there. But I worked like a dog. I mean, it did not, you know, it doesn't flow that easily, you know, that, yeah. But, so I was able to prove to myself that I could go to college, get a degree, and do what I wanted to do. And this is how I went to Syracuse, got the degree, interned at North Carolina with Hans, which was sort of interesting because I came from the behavioral background of Sandy Dean at Syracuse, who was a Spence student, an Iowa student at one point. And Hans and I got along famously because Hans, I was worried, but when I met him, when I went to North Carolina, I was worried that I was going to be just overwhelmed with psychoanalytic thinking without the ability to think for myself. And that if I raised objections, I would be running into a professor who was not sympathetic. It turned out to be just the opposite. We could sit and talk. He would explain what he thought I ought to be doing in my psychotherapy sessions. And he knew I was behaviorally oriented. They gave me practical assignments at the internship to treat obesity, of all things, one of the women there. And then there was another woman who was suicidal. And we discussed various ways on how to deal with this. And he was very open-minded. And I learned a lot from him. And most of all, I learned a great deal from his approach, his sympathy, I would say. He was a very warm and sympathetic individual. He could state his opinions, but he was not confrontative in doing so. And as you know, I became, when we were building the department, and at that point, Jim Nunnally was interested in seeing that clinical psychology had as broad a representation in the smallest number of faculty, you know, because they're a small department. So that's why I was so interested in bringing Hans there to complement Cal Izzard and myself. And what was also going on at that time, we were becoming strongly behavioral, because Charlie Spielberger had come in, Liebert had come in, and we were all riding the Spence Taylor anxiety scale, which was our, at least we thought we had some empirical evidence for what behavior therapy might be able to do. So we did become very strongly behavioral. Part of it, I think, was under Jung's pressure to publish, in fact, that it would be very hard to publish works within the framework of psychoanalytic theory. It wasn't for Hans. I mean, he was truly an expert at that, but they were not particularly empirical. And with the behavioral approach, it was empiricism was by word. And so, and if you remember, I believe you were in the meeting when Jung explained that we had to publish two articles in major theoretical journals each year. Clinical could be accepted because we had other practical things. We only had to publish one in a major journal, and then any place else would be just fine. Do you remember that?
I don't remember that, but it wasn't a big thing for me because
you were doing it. Yeah, but that really struck me. I was publishing five and six a year during those years. Uh-huh. And both Spielberger and Liebert and myself had little production factories going. Yeah. And we all were all writing a similar thing. Charlie had arranged for his state trade anxiety. I was still using variations of Spence Taylor. And so was Liebert doing the same thing. And so we were able to come up with empirical results for what they were worth during that period of time. But anyway, that is my background. I ran the family business for up until 1957, I took the night courses. By 1958, I had entered Syracuse and went through that in the 4 years. And I was going to tell you two things that were interesting. First of all, Sandy Dean took me on as a research assistant, $2,400 a year. Abe Judson, who was a consultant at Marcy State Hospital, took me on as a senior psychologist. That was another $2,400 a year. Then Nelson Rockefeller came through with scholarships for people who had low incomes. I had sold out my share of the business for $7,500 a year at that time. So I was making close to $15,000 a year going to graduate school. And with the
that was very probably better than your salary when you came here, right?
Which was $7,500. But what was so interesting is that my money gave out on the precise month that I took the job at Vanderbilt.